I'm going to talk about Datalog as a lingua franca for province querying and reasoning, joint work with a couple of students and a former postdoc now at Gonzaga, that's Sean Bowers. And we are in Davis. You see a little bit of the provenance of the group. We are at UC Davis. I'm affiliated also with the Genome Center there. We're sort of known for being a Kepler shop, if you like, or scientific workflows for the last couple of years. But more recently, and that's, you know, time flows from the left to right, more recently we're looking a lot into using Datalog, logic blocks, for example, in particular, as a mechanism to do all kinds of interesting things, including with workflows and including with provenance. Okay, so as a starting point, does anybody know how I can see the same thing here, by the way? This is very annoying. I can't read my slide. I can't look there. Okay, how do I
it's too small, yeah.
Yeah.
So you need to resize this thing.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Green. So let me start with the executive summary. The executive summary is that OPM, the open provenance model, is sort of a minimal standard, if you like, one size fits all. You can describe it when you make a cake and which eggs went into the cake or didn't go into the cake, things like that. But there are some things that are not clearly defined in OPM, almost by its nature, being a minimal standard. And for example, Jan van den Busche and colleagues have found out that the temporal semantics of OPM, when happens something before and what are the repercussions in terms of temporal order, are not quite clear. Okay, so there's a paper by them, formal account, I think, of OPM, I think is the name. And then so they introduce additional concepts into OPM, talking about precise edges and triangles and wonderful things like that. We have looked at that and said, oh yeah, indeed, for our scientific workflow world work, we need a little bit more than just OPM. We want to use OPM as a starting point, but at the same time, we want to enrich the model with constructs that capture what we care about, the traces, the provenance information from scientific workflows. So what we found is that by using Datalog, using a logic-based language, we can get pretty far and have, you know, fairly low cost. So I'll show you a couple of examples of that. I borrowed some ideas from the invited keynote yesterday. I won't have cool theorems. That's the downside. But you know, it's more, I think, about the questions that this will hopefully trigger. And so the answers, we don't have all of them, although we think of Datalog as sort of a step towards an answer to the questions. Now, before I go on, also a quick note on identifiers. I have a little quote here, and I wonder whether you know that. This is a little bit self-referential about speakers at a certain venue, and they didn't have a lot of time, so they had to hurry up. And so, for example, the speaker, Stan Hasselton from the US delegation, was by reference saying, 4, 6, 11, and therefore 22. And the conference participants had to look this up, of course, in the proceedings. You know, it would be explained what 4, 6, and 11 were. And so anyway, so goes on to say 5, 9, and therefore 22, and 3, 7, 2, 11, from which, again, it follows that 22, and only 22. And then someone jumped up saying, yes, but what about 5, and what about 6, 18, or 4, for that matter? And then Hasselton countered this objection with a crushing retort, either way, 22. Now, quick question. I have a couple more questions for you guys. What is this? From whom is that? And what is 22? Anybody knows what this is? No? Gee. Okay, so this is this guy, Stanislav Lem, Futurological Congress. And 22 is the end of the world. And I'm, Okay. So, okay. I think this is where we're going with references, but So let's go back a little bit on to the topic of what this is about. I first need to quickly introduce to you what are scientific workflows. And a quick acronym that helps me remember what it is all about is ASAP, ASAP, so it's about automation. We have scientists that want to automate steps that they normally do manually in their day-to-day, computational science jobs. Often scientists are interested in scaling. They want to run computationally intensive and data intensive jobs, not just on their laptops. They want to run it on big compute resources in the cloud, on their own cluster, whatever. We are going into a world where we have more and more collaborations, of course, between scientists, sharing big instruments and so on. The workflows themselves therefore need to be also adapted and evolve and in a hopefully more or less transparent manner Even if you're just collaborating with yourself, you know, and you look at your Perl script from 6 months ago, you know, if you've done a good job, you can still read it. If not, you know, maybe you should have used Python. So finally, provenance, and this is what brings us here. Workflows should capture the processing history and the data lineage of the computational experiments that have been executed. So we should have a traceable data evolution, if you want, a data history and the workflow evolution itself, the workflow, the script, if you like, as it evolves, should also be traced. And this whole theme is, of course, nowadays coined, the name that we use here is reproducible science. Now, of course, science always, it isn't science if it's not reproducible, but we're having new methods at our hand now to make it easier to reproduce for yourself and also for others. Okay, so just a couple of quick examples. Here's a recent bioinformatics workflow that in collaboration with the Genome Center colleague, Mark Facciotti, we have developed. You see the usual ingredients. You start with data. It undergoes various computational steps. In this case, we're trying to find motifs in sequences, in DNA sequences, and we get products. And you see there's multiple steps. Some of them are very compute intensive. Some of them should be executed in parallel, and we've built actually a prototype of this to show the, you know, how to scale that. So here's an example, an executable version. This is not just it is a PowerPoint, but it's also a snapshot of the actual executable workflow in the Kepler system. In this particular case, we're using from our colleagues from San Diego, we use their MapReduce implementation that we can, you know, make use of in Kepler. To scale up the execution to make things faster. Just another example from a workflow that we developed a few years ago. It's called Waters Workflow for the Alignment, Taxonomy, Ecology of Ribosomal Sequences. One thing that you notice here that these actors, these computational components, are, you know, fairly organized. There's almost a linear flow. This is a particular execution model that we developed at UC Davis. We call it COMAD, Collection-Oriented Modeling and Design, and the metaphor is basically one of a conveyor belt. So we found a lot of problems with scientific workflow design. Workflows often look very complicated like this and in a way ugly and not necessarily better than other workflow-based approaches. So we came up with something to you know, basically a design paradigm that makes things more linear and therefore more understandable for humans. So this is all about workflows. Now let's switch to provenance. And so I hope you're going to get up to speed now with the answers. So I had a lot of questions. What I want to know from you guys here is when you look at a provenance graph like this, what do you see? What is implied? So let's first agree on a couple of conventions. We have these circles. These represent data objects. These boxes represent processes, execution steps, code, something like that. In the OPM parlance, we would say that the process P used an item X. It could be an egg, but it could be a DNA sequence. It used it, and then it produced an item Y. So we say Y was generated by P. Okay? So X was used, and Y was generated. Or in the terminology that I like to use, you know, we don't do much with baking cakes and eggs, so we just say read and write. Yeah, I read some data, and I write some data. So if you have that, if your provenance graph has this information, what do you know? For example, can you now state that Y was derived from X? So who thinks that Y was derived from X? Who thinks Y wasn't, one? Anybody else? Y might have been derived from X. Who thinks, lots of people think might. Who thinks that Y was not derived from X? Any other choices? Okay. So the point here is that indeed, it is very suggestive the way I've written it, and it's often assumed that Y was derived from X because X was read and Y was written. And that's what, you know, we all should assume by default, maybe. But it turns out that's actually not right. And there are a couple of reasons for that, and I'll elaborate that in the next examples. Indeed, if you look at OPM, the standard, it will not formally allow you to derive logically that Y was derived from X just by having observed the read and the write, or the, as they call it, used and generated by. Yeah, it doesn't follow. If you say, give me everything that this depends on, you will not get that back. Okay, and that's in a way correct. And here's an explanation why this is correct. So let's look at the provenance quiz part two. let's assert that Z, yeah, so we have again two steps, process A and process B, and we have these three data items, X, Y, Z. And let's say that somebody has asserted explicitly that Z was in fact derived from X. Okay, so it, we know that. Some, you know, provenance recorder, some systems, whoever implemented this workflow system or the actors, the components in it, says that Z was derived from X. Can we now say that indeed, well, what can we follow? Can we, for example, follow that the read step, the reading of the Y by PB, preceded the writing? Yeah, so, I mean, normally we would assume that, right? We read this and then therefore we write it, and that's why it was derived. So this is a possibility, but there's also a second read step, a read three. PB could also use that to derive Z, or both. So the problem is, Z could have been derived by reading the Y, by reading the X, or both, or something else that the provenance graph has forgotten to record. So again, if we're very formal, and even if we know explicitly that Z was derived from X, we don't have enough information to, for example, say something about the temporal order of events. Oftentimes we record the temporal order ourselves, but maybe we haven't recorded this, or it's a distributed setting. So I'm just pointing out problems here with reasoning. So the question is, can we, by knowing these things that the graph talks about, can we now conclude that the reading and two, the second read event here, necessarily preceded the write event two, or similarly, and or whether the read event three preceded the write event two? And again, the answer, if no further information is available, we cannot infer either statement. In particular, we don't know whether the path from XPA, from X through the, you know, A step A and Y and Z was used, or the other one through B, or yet another one that we haven't looked at. So the cause, we don't quite know the cause. I guess the point that I'm making here, we have observables of different nature, temporal ones, reading and write observables, but we have not specified, we have not axiomatized how one set of observables implies another set of conclusions that we want to draw. We have not formalized that. Yeah, and certainly the standards that are out there don't give us much in terms of that. Okay, so the OPM semantics, the good news is it doesn't imply that the read of I, any particular one, was prior to the write, and that's a good thing, because as we just looked at the example, as we saw, there might be other reasons why things happen that way. In fact, the write operations could even precede the read operations. I'll have an example of that later. Yeah. So OPM is silent about such inferences, and that's maybe not a good thing. So we need a formalism to specify that. So going on with our little quiz, and hope to have a little bit more participation now. Okay. What about this one? Are provenance graphs acyclic? Yeah, provenance graphs are acyclic. No. No? Oh, provocative statement. Why not? Well, this could be a bug, right? So, all right, good. Yeah. So cycles are often evil, and we don't like them, and we often say provenance graphs are DAGs, directed acyclic graphs, and they often are. Often, but not always. So let's look at that. So again, we look at the semantics. We need to look at the meaning of these edges and these observables. So for example, if these relations that we really write here, the read event, the write event, and other events, if they are meant to represent causation or temporal dependencies, then of course they should be acyclic. I mean, we live in the world where we cannot assassinate our own grandfather. That's, we don't have time travel, and it's good that way, I think. Yeah. So causal relationships and temporal relationships are acyclic. That's great. So what's going on here? Maybe that's really just a bug. It should, if the read and write events have a temporal semantics associated with it, then this is possibly a bug. Okay. On the other hand, if we have other relationships, then cycles are possibly okay. So here's another thing. What have I drawn here? Has anybody heard the term prospective provenance? no prospective province. Some people use it for the workflow itself. I see I'm running a little bit late on time. How long do I have? Okay, thank you. What about this one here? Here the cycle is fine, and why? The prospective provenance, what people sometimes call prospective provenance, is really a workflow. So the way, in our conventional way we draw these things, we have a workflow that has a cycle, and that's a fine thing. Yeah, workflows with feedback loops are common, in fact, in some of our applications, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. So we have here two levels. One is the specification level, where we have a workflow, and the other is a trace. And these two things, we need to distinguish them. Sometimes we're conflating them. Some workflow systems don't distinguish these two levels because their workflows and their traces look very similar. But in general, that's not the case. So what we define, and others I think have done similar things before, is really identify two layers that we need to talk about. One is the workflow layer, and then the other is the layer of the traces, of the runs, of the instances of the workflow, if you like. And you see carefully color-coded that the workflow specification is solid, and we have a certain terminology now that goes with this. So, for example, you see the big X up there is what we could call a data container or a channel where the data lives. It could be a folder on your laptop. It could be some space in a cloud. So then you read from that. At the specification level, we can think of this as an in-edge and an out-edge that go in and out of these computational components. Now, the important thing that I want to emphasize, and I'm not sure the slide makes it very clear, we can have many instances, many traces, many of these hollow graphs in the bottom that correspond to one workflow graph, one specification. And the reason is that scientific workflows, as a first approximation, you can think of them as batch programs, scripts, you know, the old decks, if you remember those, no, probably not. So you run the same operation on a bunch of files. So they're really sort of batch oriented and in a way like a map in Lisp or a for loop, right? And so you have not just one instance of a trace, but many. So in that data container X, lots of little X's live, yeah? Okay? Now, so the interesting thing that we observed is, well, if we stare at the traces only, and then start reason about the observables, the read and the write events, and what's the temporal meaning and all of that, it's not quite clear what's going on. So we propose to declare at the schema level, at the workflow specification level, certain properties. So we annotate the workflow specification with the temporal semantics, and then from that follows certain inferences at the instance level. So for example, we might have a data constraint. You see that around the Y data container. And that essentially means that you cannot read an item before you've written it. Yeah, you can't read something from a container before somebody else has written that very thing in there. Similarly, a firing constraint around the box A could mean, you don't always have that, but it could mean that before something is written by A, it has to be read, so this implies another temporal constraint. You see the little f, less than equal f and less than equal d. Again, the point is here we have two levels, workflow land and trace land, as we sometimes call them. We map between them. Often traces look similar to workflows. We can define a homomorphism. That's a simple structural constraint if you want to do it that way. And then a temporal semantics is implied, okay? So now, and data lock enters here. So far, those are interesting concepts, but how do we specify these things? Now, you have to read the paper, okay? It's short, it's only 4 pages, but let me just look at one rule here, okay? So this rule looks a little bit cryptic, but if you're, a card-carrying member of the data lock or logic programming community, you can easily read this. What this says, let me read it to you. The first rule is written in the form of a denial, and a denial is a good thing. You specify the situations that you don't want, and this defines an integrity constraint. So the first rule says, if I have a read observable of D and I, so one is, so we have to look at this picture one more time real quick. So you see this homomorphism maps from data instances to data containers and from invocations to processes, yeah? So the little a is mapped to the big A, and the little x is mapped to the big X. And then, so you now relate the items that live down here, the concrete data items and the concrete process invocations, to the specification level. And when you do that, then you can say, well, if my homomorphism, for example, is violated, and then you create this these violation witnesses, if a certain condition holds. So basically what they're saying is that there is no in-edge from the container to the process. So basically the trace says, or claims, makes a claim that a data item was read by an invocation, but you don't see that the corresponding data container and the corresponding process are connected. So that's not possible. That should not have happened. Yeah? And similar for the write edge. So again, basically we observe a read here, but on the schema level, things don't match up. Yeah? So that would be a specification of that. The larger point here is that this is just a rule. These are two lines. Okay, you might not understand fully the details of this rule, but I can specify this association between traces and a workflow level using two lines of data log. Yeah. And then I can run this and I can test traces. Is this trace a valid trace relative to this workflow with respect to the structure? Now, similarly, you can do this for temporal semantics. And I don't want to go into that too much here. Again, it's in the paper, but you define, the key idea is that you define the before relationship. Yeah. So the certain meanings that you have at the specification level, at the workflow level, imply then a before relationship, you know, temporally before. And that must then be acyclic. And of course, there's nothing easier to, in data log than to check whether a certain relation is cyclic or not. So can you can use data log as a language to specify integrity constraints, and then to test them, run them, and all of that is, you know, fairly straightforward and easy. Again, in the interest of time, I don't want to go into those. Please look at them. They're not difficult to understand. What you then get is then that this, you know, world of workflows and provenance traces has been sort of specified or axiomatized using these little prolog facts. Did I say prolog? Gee, I meant to say data log. I'll say something about prolog in a second. So the important point here is that the data constraints and fine constraints at the schema level imply certain connections at the trace level that you should observe, and you can use a data log engine to check. Thank you. I think my sponsors here on the logic blocks. Okay, and so that we can then check this. Okay, at runtime. Now, before I let you go to lunch, I need to tell you about Hamming numbers. These are wonderful things. So Hamming numbers, also known as regular numbers, are basically the multiples of 2, 3, and 5. And it's a very common programming problem. I suggest you try it in your favorite programming language. Please create the sequence of all numbers. It's an infinite sequence, all right, of multiples of 2, 3, and 5 in order. No, just makes a wonderful programming exercise. Now, in a data flow process network, as, for example, our workflows are, it's rather simple. And this problem was looked at, for example, by Dijkstra and so on. It's a fun little problem. And you have a workflow that looks cyclic, but that's not really a problem because there's an actor in there called the delay actor, which has an interesting property. It writes first something, and then it reads something. What does it do? It's basically like a queue where there's you have a start element in the queue already to get the pump primed, so to say. So you're priming the pump. You're pushing out an item, in this case the number one, and you send it into this network, and you notice that things flow back. Yeah, you see the mouse is here. Things flow back here. So any numbers that go through here are pushed back here again. So you have an infinite process. That's not necessarily a bad thing if it's, you know, incrementally computed. So this network will compute, or this workflow will compute an increasing sequence of multiples of 2, 3, and 5. It's very elegant, very neat, and has certain assumptions like actors, the delay actor that writes something and then reads something. The merge actors, by the way, are exactly the merge steps that you know from merge sort. They just pick the small of two items. So that's how it actually creates them in order. Now, there's different ways to write this program or this workflow. And if you look at the differences, they're rather subtle. One I call the Hamming 1 version, and the other Hamming 3. The Hamming 3 has, in a way, three loops. Yeah. So these two workflows are almost the same. And I hit the wrong button. So here's the last quiz for the day. Can you find out the trace on the left to which workflow it belongs, to Hamming workflow 1 or 3? They look very similar, Again, on the left you see the trace, on the right you see the workflow specification. As it turns out, these red dashed edges in the trace cannot be mapped to one of the two workflows. So therefore, one violates that homomorphism constraint. So it cannot be, this trace can only belong to one of the workflows. It can only belong to workflow one and not workflow three, because these red edges, you don't know what they map to. There's nothing corresponding at the schema level. Why is this interesting? Because if you create these prominence traces, you see here on the left something I call the fish, and on the right something that I call the sail, for obvious reasons. These are the Hamming numbers produced by these workflows together with their provenance. So for example, basically these numbers are the multiples of 2, 3, and 5. If you look at the number 6, for example, 6 is 2 times 3, but it's also 3 times 2. So there's two ways to derive the number 6. There's two derivations. And in the fish sort of provenance and the corresponding workflow, all possible combinations are generated that way. Whereas in the sail version, every number has exactly one derivation. Okay, so the number 6 is derived as 2 times 3. It is not derived as 3 times 2. Okay, and if you look at the workflow and try to analyze it, you'll see it. The interesting thing is you see it from the provenance much easier, and the workflows look almost identical. But if you run them and then look at the provenance, you see that they're really strikingly different, and one is probably much more efficient because every number is derived once. In the other case, every number is derived in so many ways, yeah, because of the duplicates that are generated and so on. So wrapping up, so the other message, and here I use the P word again, if you want to test your provenance models, what we are suggesting is, you know, use a language like Datalog as a mechanism to specify the constraints as well as queries. So you can now do reasoning, querying and reasoning, and I put together a little hack, which is a hybrid and between Prolog and Datalog, where I use one language as a glue language and the other one as a declarative query language to basically generate, in this case, path queries that I then execute on these provenance graphs. To illustrate this real quick, so if you query the fish, you could say, well, I'm interested in queries or in paths of the form multiples of 2, then multiples of 3, and then multiples of 5, and only in this order. And then you get a subgraph of the provenance graph, which you see on the right. Yeah. So the point that I'm making here is that it's very easy to use a logic language to now query these provenance traces. Okay. So if you formalize this, you would write it as follows. You have the provenance graph is modeled as a graph G of labeled edges. It could have cycles. Let's say you're only interested in the multiples of 2, followed by the multiples of 3, followed by the multiples of 5. This is how you would write it down. Then you get, for example, when you query the fishy provenance graph on the left, you'll get then these highlighted edges on the right. So let me close by saying that we're looking at models of provenance, including OPM. We found that this is, by design, pretty much only a starting point, but we need a simple do-it-yourself language to test models of provenance, to compare them, to run examples, to understand what's going on. And what we propose and what we've shown that it's possible because some of these things we've prototypically implemented both in DLV, Prolog, and in logic blocks, that Datalog makes a good do-it-yourself language to try out these things. And this is currently happening. The Data One Provenance Working Group that I'm co-leading together with Paolo, and of which James is also a member, and others, we're developing an extension, if you like, of OPM for scientific workflows. And we're trying to use Datalog as a mechanism both to specifying and to debugging our definitions. And as far as I know, the W3C Provenance Working Group is going similar routes. It's all Datalog, all the way down. Okay, thank you. Sorry for going a little later. Thanks.
Other club, so you can get away
can get pretty far. I think that's what this exercise is showing. Yeah. But types are fine too. But yeah, but we like untyped stuff as well. And I can show this. Yeah, if somebody wants to see a little demo over the break or so, I'll be happy to show you how that actually works.
I just thank the speaker one more time.
Thank you.